Thanks very much indeed, and it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the Global Progressive Forum and Respublica for organizing this meeting. And I want also to say, pay a word of tribute to the remarkable leadership of Paul Rasmussen over many years of the Parliamentary European Socialists. A leadership of true conceptual originality and I think great historical importance. As an American, it's a particular privilege for me to have a role in these discussions, and I also need to say that as a Texan, I would like to thank those who arranged the climate in this room for making me feel quite at home. A crisis is necessarily and properly a time for reflection, introspection. Why are we in trouble? What did we do wrong? How can we improve? And I think the conduct of the socialist governments affected by the crisis here in Greece, also in Spain, has been realistic and disciplined. It's been free of false populism, bluster, or threats, conscious of the need for internal reforms, on the lookout for feasible measures that might mitigate the damage, seriously attentive to the crushing external pressures, and alert to the complex politics behind those pressures. Austerity and adjustment are inevitable in crisis, but there are better and worse ways to proceed. And one hallmark of the socialist approach must be to avoid inflicting gratuitous harm on weak victims, something that we have actually seen and are seeing in the ostentatious austerity programs of some right-wing governments. Austerity for its own sake, austerity to take the excuse of mounting an attack on long-standing targets in the welfare state, austerity to show off how tough you are, austerity to show how much pain you can inflict. There is a difference, and it's an important difference, and it's a difference which shows up at the level of national politics. Having said that, let's also recognize that this is a global and a systematic crisis. It is not a Portuguese, Irish, Greek, or Spanish crisis. And indeed, when you think about that unflattering acronym, PIGS, you have to ask yourself, who invented it? Where did it come from? My understanding is that it came from an analyst at Goldman Sachs. One is entitled to doubt that that was entirely accidental. And I suggest perhaps that it might be useful going forward to change the reference of that acronym to something like Principal Instigator, Goldman Sachs. The same flaws that were, that are now singled out for criticism in those countries I just mentioned, were not very long ago excused, overlooked, and readily financed in the upswing of the credit expansion. So what's changed was not the condition of the debtors, but the credit conditions in the larger world economy. Why did they change? They changed because in September of 2007 already, it came to be recognized that the global financial system had been subjected to a vast swindle. a swindle originating in the American mortgage markets. Millions of mortgages, subprime mortgages, so-called Alt-A mortgages, mortgages known as liar's loans, as ninja loans because their recipients had no income, no job, or assets, as neutron loans because they were destined to explode, destroying the people but leaving the buildings intact. These mortgages were, in effect, counterfeits. They were destined, when issued, to default if they could not be refinanced in 2 or 3 years. And the lenders, the originators, knew this very well. They were putting people into homes who they knew could not document their incomes, whose credit histories were bad, and they were giving loans on those homes which had been appraised at multiples of the actual market value of the house. This is intrinsically a dishonest practice. There is no reason why a mortgage lender would ever accept an inflated appraisal on a house unless it was simply a matter of selling the loan for an inflated fee. Those counterfeits were then laundered in an exact equivalent of a money laundering operations. They were transformed from dirty to clean, from triple B minus to triple A by the actions of the ratings agencies, something which you've already made reference to. The rating agencies were doing this because that was a very large share, as much as 80% of their business. And the quality, or I should say, their willingness to give a triple A rating to a triple B asset determined their market share and their profitability. Ratings agencies were once quite good at evaluating commercial credit, say, the capacity of a corporation to pay its bonds. But we were now talking about mortgages, bundles of payments for millions of people. And the mortgage and the ratings agencies never looked at the underlying loan documentation because they did not want to know about the actual quality of the borrowers. So they were complicit, essentially, in a laundering scheme. And the third stage in the network was a fencing operation. The passing of these laundered counterfeits onto the legitimate market. The fence, the entity which sells stolen goods, was the investment and the commercial banking organizations. The ultimate buyers were, in many cases, European. Pension funds and banks and others who had come to place a trust in the reliability of that AAA rating. So we have all the elements here of a criminal enterprise, and I use that word in the technical sense, not for rhetorical effect, because it is precisely what we are describing. People were swindled, defrauded of vast sums, and that is something that demands a judicial response. Not merely a regulatory response, although regulation and supervision are extremely important going forward, it is also necessary to clean up the practices of the institutions and to clean out the people who are responsible for those practices. This is normal practice. We did it 20 years ago in the savings and loan crisis, and 1,000 insiders from that industry went to federal prison in that case in the United States. So I'm not speaking of something which is unprecedented. I'm speaking of something which is legal practice normally, but which needs to get underway for this crisis to be finally resolved. And one of the things I think it would be extremely useful for those who articulate a socialist and social democratic response as they speak to the American authorities, or for that matter to the investigating and judicial authorities in their own countries, is that they insist on the priority of effective investigations and, as appropriate, indictments and prosecutions in these matters. It will be an important force in making this step in the recovery from the financial crisis happen. And I have to say that so far there is only one country which is setting the pace, which is acting as the model for the pursuit of the fraudulent element in the financial crisis, and that country is Iceland, which did in fact send Interpol to Luxembourg to pick up four senior officers of one of the major failed banks. It has put one in London under a request for extradition, and has frozen the assets and pursued a case in New York courts for yet another. So this is something which can be done, which is being done, and which needs to be done much more comprehensively and on a much larger scale. Now, the crisis began in the United States, but it spread to Europe and to Southern Europe. Why was that? Clearly, there was a global flight to safety, to the security of the United States Treasury bill and to the bonds of Germany and France. But why was it away from the bonds of the small and the southern European countries, and not small northern, or for that matter, the large European countries? Why were these particular bonds suddenly deemed unsafe? I think the answer to that needs to be sought on three levels. One relates to the performance of the capital markets, a second to the economic provisions of the European Charter, and thirdly to the constitutional structure of the European Union itself. As far as the character of public debt markets are concerned, again, that issue has already been touched on in this panel, but it seems to me worth pointing out that the innovation of credit default swaps, which are effectively a way of selling bonds without owning them, fundamentally changes the character of sovereign debt markets, and in a way which probably cannot be reversed. That is to say, it is very hard for me to imagine a world in which the situation that existed, let's say, 10 years ago, when small countries could effectively sell revenue bonds on capital markets in a predictable and safe way, will return, because it is now possible to sell those bonds massively in very sudden ways in order to manipulate their price and take advantage of the resulting volatility. And that is a world which we have entered and from which we probably will not exit, suggesting that we really do need to think, and Paul Rasmussen spoke about this earlier, of creating mechanisms which are larger than the markets, more stable than the markets, and that effectively replace the markets as the funding mechanism for capital expenditure in smaller countries. The relevant economic provisions of the European Charter are two. First of all, the arbitrary, capricious, and in any event outdated, and yet still in many people's minds sacrosanct, objectives of a 3% of GDP deficit and a 60% of GDP debt to GDP ratio. Whatever the original purpose of those goals, and they did serve a purpose at the time of the movement to unify European currencies, they are clearly inappropriate to a global financial crisis. And everyone who is technically involved in these questions knows this. If you ask, and I have done so, but if you ask the senior economic staff of the International Monetary Fund, why not 80% of GDP? Why not 100% of GDP as your goal? And why not 2025 or 2050 as your date for reaching that goal rather than 2015, they have no answer to that question. They have no answer to that question. There is no answer to that question. These are simply, as I said before, arbitrary and capricious standards which have somehow become stuck in law and in people's minds, and which are now highly destructive in their effect on the social structure of Europe. The second relevant treaty provision concerns the role of the central bank, which is very different from that in the United States. The Federal Reserve is statutorily charged with furnishing an elastic currency. It's a term of the US law. The European Central Bank was formally focused on price and monetary stability and denied the role of lender of last resort. This is now, I think we all recognize, already effectively a dead letter, as the European Central Bank has come to recognize, grudgingly, but nevertheless to recognize as necessary, the reality that it must become the buyer of last resort for sovereign debt. And it is buying sovereign debt. It is doing so as we speak. It has been doing so for some days. And I think that is the reason why the crisis in recent days has eased, why Spain, for example, was able to issue sovereign debt a few days ago, and why the euro has stopped its precipitate decline in relationship to the dollar. So this is a good sign, but it is good to be realistic about this and to point out to the central bank when it is in fact taking a step in the direction of an appropriate degree of flexibility and away from dogmatism in its response to the crisis. If I may be permitted a historical reference, this is not the first time that Europe committed itself by treaty to an unrealistic economic goals imposed for political reasons. The previous major instance was at Versailles in 1919, with the difference being that at that time the conditions were imposed on Germany, whereas now they're being imposed by Germany. But that's a minor distinction. It's not the important point. They were totally unrealistic then, and they're totally unrealistic now. And then, as now, as John Maynard Keynes wrote in 1920, the inevitable necessity is for a revision of the treaty. The constitutional issue raises, I think, a set of even more profound considerations. And here again, I will simply make a few references to what seem to me to be the appropriate historical parallels. Europe is a confederation. It is basically a customs union combined with a currency union and a great many other regulatory structures, but those from an economic standpoint are the essential features. We have experience with that. We've had two confederacies in North America. We got rid of the first one when we adopted our Constitution in the early 1790s. And the second one failed in 1865. Important point about that second American Confederacy is that the economic consequences of that failure, which were a backward, impoverished, undeveloped South, a very large part of the country, those consequences went on for a very long time. They went on effectively for almost 70 years, and the situation did not begin to be resolved until Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal in 1933. We tend to think of the New Deal as a response to the financial crisis and the Great Crash and the Great Depression of 1930 to 33. But it was, in fact, far more than that. A better way of thinking is to say that the financial crisis of 1929 was the last gasp of an effort to create prosperity in the United States on the basis purely of private finance. The New Deal was transformational, and that transformation began in the American South with the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Rural Electrification Administration, and ultimately the Social Security system, which created a national or a continental basis for stabilizing the incomes of the old. This was the first effort that was remotely adequate to the task. And only when it was undertaken on a scale never before seen did the United States begin to forge a fully national economy capable of resolving mass unemployment, which was 25% in 1933, and containing the pressures for mass migration, which was occurring and continued to occur through this period. This coincided with the innovation of Keynesian economics and the large-scale application of expansionary fiscal policies on the continental scale as the general means to resolve what was both a structural and a financial crisis. And that fact also is not accidental. So it seems to me worth recognizing that ultimately this too should be on the agenda for progressive and socialist forces in thinking realistically about what will be required to resolve the present situation. To summarize, within the limited means available to governments in Europe, the socialist program is, and in my view, it should continue to be, one of reform, innovation, imagination, protection of the vulnerable, and an honest search for the best ways to advance. But at the same time, there are larger issues: jobs, growth, care for the elderly, climate change, which will not be resolved at the national level, and probably cannot be resolved without confronting and articulating the larger economic, legal, and constitutional issues that face Europe as a single integrated economic region. Those problems do exist, and sooner or later, they will need to be dealt with effectively. Thank you very much.